Hi everybody, it's Saturday again and it's Dom here, letting you know there's another release out, and this is episode 150, 150 episodes, who'd have thought, yeah? And we're still around to talk, at the moment anyway. This week we had the pleasure of chatting with Matt Sergiu, who is radio presenter, former journalist and club DJ, and he runs Conspirio TV, or Conspirio Media, if you want to look him up on YouTube. I'll put all the links in the show notes. And he's looked into the occult side of the Beatles story and many other 60s counterculture type movements as well. And his research is absolutely amazing. And it was a great pleasure to chat with him for a couple of hours. And it won't be the last time, I don't think. He's just a nice bloke. We just got on really well. Anyway, one other thing to mention is that I had some horrendous bandwidth issues this week. Cut a long story short, my neighbour's internet went off. BT came round, fixed theirs and pulled mine out. And for about 5 to 10 days, we had absolutely horrendous broadband coverage. So it's affected my audio slightly, which it sounds slightly tinny. It's very listenable, but it sounds slightly tinny. It's not the usual quality sound. The other guys are fine, but that's it. That's just life, innit, I suppose. This show won't be available on YouTube, although we might try and put the first hour on. It also won't be going on Podomatic. I'm still above my bandwidth on Podomatic. Seems to be a bandwidth intro, this, doesn't it? But anyway, there you go. But it will be at sheepfound.co.uk. That's sheepfound.co.uk. If you go there, you'll get the first hour. If you remember, you get the full hour. Full run time is just over 2 hours, I do believe. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Okay, I hope you enjoy it. But welcome back to another Sheep Farm podcast. Chris is with us as usual.
Good evening.
There, Chris, you've got your bottle of
Shiraz with me, actually, yes.
Shiraz, have you? And joining us tonight, I mean, since 2020, I've got to say, being Mr. Unsociable, I've met more people on podcasts and got to know more people in the last 3 or 4 years. So thanks, Satanist parasites. For doing this. We did 4 shows with this chap in the summer with Mark Devlin. It's Matt Sergiu. I've probably destroyed his name there. Have I pronounced that right?
Yeah, that was brilliant. Hello. Ooh, brilliant. Yeah, you did it. You did it. Hooray! Right.
Yeah. I normally destroy him because Yorkshire and fancy sounding surnames don't generally go together.
Yeah, it's a Greek Cypriot name, and it's actually pronounced Sergiu. But no one said Yil, apparently, but no one ever says that, obviously. So it's become Sergiu. Just people look at it and say Sergiu, and I'm all right with that.
That sounds quite powerful, Sergiu, to me. It's like a power name.
Sergiu Toscini.
Yeah.
And all of that. Yeah.
Taking us back to the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Of course. And showing our age.
Before we crack on, right, where can people find your work?
There's quite a few sites, actually. I've got the site Conspiro Media, which is, I think, off the top of my head, I should really be more organized than this, shouldn't I? I think it's conspiromediawordpress.com, I think it is. But yeah, if you just type in Conspiro Media, all one word, Conspiro Media. If you type in all one word, it'll come up. There's also the Facebook page for that. And on the Facebook page for that, you get an amalgamation of things that you would find on Conspira Media and also at my other site, The Occult Beatles, where I take a look at the conspiratorial occult world of the Beatles. And I've also got Conspiro TV, again, all one word, which is my YouTube page. I've also got a Spreaker page. But yeah, Conspiro Media, it started in 2011, but for the last few years, since 2016, basically what I've been looking at and where all my efforts and attentions have been focused on is researching the 60s so-called counterculture of London, of the UK. And that's partly inspired by what Dave McGowan discovered in America, in California, LA, at Laurel Canyon. So partly inspired by his work, I thought to myself, well, if there is, as Dave McGowan argued, this military so-called elite intelligence linked connection to the so-called counterculture of America, then it would only make sense that it would be the same in Britain, because Britain was absolutely central to the whole countercultural so-called summer of love that took place in 66, 67, 68. Because of course you've got the Beatles who were at the forefront of that, and the Beatles were British. So Britain would have had to have been central to that, or very important to what was going on at Laurel Canyon and collectively throughout the whole countercultural scene of America. So I started looking into the London scene back in 2016, and I had the feeling that that was probably the case, that Britain was probably had the same kind of thing going on as what Dave McGowan argued was going on in America. That was my idea when I went into it to have a look. And that was my suspicion. And my suspicions have been kind of confirmed. There are definitely links to military and intelligence and all of the other stuff that you would come to expect in a conspiratorial world when it comes to the 60s so-called counterculture of Britain, but London predominantly. That's where a lot of it was going on. But they didn't call it the counterculture back then. They called it the underground. People who are involved in the countercultural scene have sent me emails, who were involved in it or were following it as teenagers back in the day, have sent me emails saying, love what you're doing, Matt, but just be aware that we didn't call it the counterculture. We called it the underground. That's what it was called in Britain. Conspiro Media, my website, since about 2016. Since about 2016, that's what I've been looking at, and that's what a lot of my work has been focused on. Really. I mean,
we were talking, weren't we, Matt, over email, me, you, Chris, and Mark Devlin. There's so many overlaps with our work, with your work that we've been doing on the Huxley Brave New World, and even some of the other stuff as well. But also Dave McGowan's work. I think he's an inspiration, or inspired quite a few of us old gits now to carry on the type of research that you were doing. And I think there's a number of reasons why, because if you're writing a book about that, it's very difficult to argue with what the mainstream are putting out as truth. And he used what the mainstream were putting out as truth as his evidence. It's very difficult to argue against or anybody sue you, because it's not an opinion, is it? But anyway, that's another story.
That was his research style, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
I was going to say, the way I see it is, okay, so Dave McGowan looked at Jim Morrison, for example, and noticed that his father was central to the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident, which led to the escalation of troops going into Vietnam and as a result escalated the Vietnam War in the 60s. If that was just one isolated case where you look to a 60s so-called countercultural figure and you think, okay, that's isolated case, fine, okay, these things happen. But when you look at what Dave McGowan discovered about, for example, Dave Crosby, about Papa John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas, and on and on and on, the list goes on. Frank Zappa was another one. The list just keeps going on and on and on. You think, come on, you know, out of all these music stars, these anti-establishment figures, these supposed anti-establishment figures who are around in this countercultural milieu, if you like, to use a posh word, that were around in the 60s, what the majority of them came from this kind of world? Come on. You know, the law of averages would say that's impossible, to use one of your, to paraphrase you in one of your Brave New World Order podcasts. It's impossible.
It is impossible. There's no way. Again, all those massive bands that became massive bands, and not only that, all the hit records that they wrote in such a small area, in such a small time, and they were all linked to military or military intelligence, etc., etc. That just couldn't happen.
And like Dave McGowan says, like he states in his book, why did they go there? There was no music scene. You know, these are like bands and singers that were looking to become famous. All right, if they were famous and they went there and set up their own scene because they wanted to make their own scene away from the major record companies to be more autonomous, fine. But they were all, this was pre-fame. They went to a place basically where there was no live music scene, no record companies, no agents, no A&R men, producers and all of that. Why would you go, and all of you, like not just one or two but all of them, and converge in this area where there's nothing that is going to make them be discovered, if you like, and become stars, you know? So what, yeah, again, but it's impossible, you know.
They all had a nice romantic backstory as why they went there.
Oh yeah, it's all it's beautiful and it was scenic and it was all very romantic.
I bumped into a guy and then we decided just to pop over there.
In fact, one of the stories, famous stories, I think it were in McGowan's book, was that the guy, Crosby's mate, what they call him, Graham Nash, the other one, who was in Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Neil Young?
Well, there was Neil Young and the other guy, wasn't there? What's he called?
Stephen Stills.
Stephen Stills. He just happened to come from Canada or wherever he came from to Laurel Canyon, and he bumped into his mate, Neil Young.
The other one I was thinking.
No. it just didn't happen, did it? Let's be quite honest. It didn't.
Just as a caveat, have you read Programme to Kill, Matt?
No, I haven't, not yet.
Because that's an interesting one as well, because it's Dave McGowan's other one, and it's about serial killers. But like you were saying, I remember I read it years ago, and it's basically saying that all serial killers are military or intelligence or whatever, you know, part of Operation Phoenix, where in Vietnam they'd murder or chop someone up and leave them in the street to terrorize them. And he's basically saying all the serial killers, you know, they're not what we've been taught they are. And I remember thinking, but surely English ones are, not just American. I know, because I was convinced after reading his book that, you know, it were all the shenanigans. But then I thought, surely not the English ones. But then you look into that for 10 minutes and you find that Jimmy Savile knew Peter Sutcliffe. Jimmy Savile played a thing where a disco where, what's her name? Tom Brady and Mary Lou. And there's all these other little weird connections. Savile's his friends with Sutcliffe in prison, and the woman, what's her name, Mary Lindley, were dating, what's her name, the one who, what's that one, where, on the road where there was a guy and a woman and he was a builder, he was burying him in the floorboards. They dated each other in prison, and you know, just weird little
Fred
caveats
like
that.
Fred West.
Yeah, apparently she was dating Meyer Hindley in prison. I mean, it's just weird. The old point towards, funny enough, I'm thinking about
an organized group.
A fellow was telling me at work that he's been watching the Peter Sutcliffe thing. I think BBC have done something on it. And then you remember that story of how many times he got caught and then he didn't get caught. And then just when they were close to catching him, some Geordie guy put a thing out saying it was him. So it took all the evidence somewhere else. So I'm not saying all the cops were in on it, but was someone diverting the case as it went along? Do you know what I mean?
I'm sure
to keep him out there terrorizing, you know.
Have I got this wrong? But wasn't one or two of the bodies found out in Roundhay Park in Leeds?
Which is Jimmy Savile's house.
Yeah, exactly. And didn't they call him in? Didn't the police call him in some dental?
Yeah, that's right.
Dental records or something, because they matched with one of the victims. They found
I don't know about the dental, but I know
they certainly called him in. It was across the road from his flat in Roundhay Park.
I seem to remember something about dental records, but don't quote me on that. Yeah. But I seem to remember they called him in and they wanted to get his dental records and see if it matched with the tooth marks of one of the victims that they found.
He wrote the Programme to Kill book. I think it's in the intro. I'm going to read it again, actually. It's in the intro. Henry Lee Lucas, that guy in America who basically said he kept owning up to every murder that had happened. And he was in Texas, and he got pardoned from the death sentence by George W. Bush. And he was the only person that George W. Bush actually pardoned. I mean, it describes now, including like an old woman whose husband used to beat her up her entire life. She murdered him. She got the chair. Everyone got the chair except for Henry Lucas. And that's what got McGowan looking into the serial killer story.
and Bush was ex-CIA head as well for a bit. And I seem to remember reading years ago, again, I don't know in what context it was, but in court, Sutcliffe actually did mention, when he was on the stand, he mentioned Jimmy Savile's name. Right. I can't remember what context that was in now. So, but he was thinking of him and talking about him at the trial. So
there's pictures of them together in Broadmoor, isn't there?
Broadmoor, isn't it? Shaking hands with Frank Bruno.
Yeah. Frank Bruno said he got taken by surprise, like Jimmy Savile set him up.
Which didn't surprise me, but... Who knows? Again, are they leading people into a secret?
Maybe we need
Frank Bruno went gaga, didn't
it? Maybe we need a program to kill UK.
What was that? Have you seen that clip of This Is Your Life?
Which one?
And I might be, again, forgive me, I might be getting this wrong, but we are sort of free flowing here. So I'm just going. I can't remember who it was about. I think it was about Frank Bruno. And I think you can find this clip. Someone's actually edited it. So it's just that bit. And it's got Frank Bruno, and it's, and I think it's Michael Aspel who's hosting it, and he says, okay, we're now going to go over by video to Phil Collins. And Phil Collins, oh, is it Gary Glitter? It might be Gary Glitter or Frank Bruno. There's some kind of connection, but Phil Collins says, hey, you know, and he makes some reference to children or something, and gives him a nudge and a wink or something. I can't remember, but yeah, go find it on YouTube.
I think I have seen that, Matt. You're ringing bells now, but yeah. But there's so many. I mean, I've just been. Chris told me about a book called Dunblane Unburied that were written in the mid 2000s by a lady called Sandra Utley. If she's still around, I wouldn't mind a conversation with Sandra. Very brave lady. She was a nurse back in 1996. And she, obviously, when Dunblane happened, she was there in Dunblane Hospital on the evening shift. So. Obviously, there's a lot of people traumatised in that. She ended up dating one of the fathers of one of the children that got killed. And he'd set up this, he was the chairman of this fund for Dunblane or whatever it was. I might have got that wrong, so don't quote me on that bit. But so he was getting access to documents, is what I'm trying to say. And she ended up being his secretary. Yeah. So she was reading all these documents of the inquiry and stuff like that. And, she realized that something weren't quite right, so she started, really saw the massive errors within the inquiry. And when you read it, and you read about Thomas Hamilton, you can see that he was linked to some of the high up police and judges in that area, and they had to get rid of him.
When he scout leaded him.
Well, he was, but he wasn't. He got kicked out, but nobody said out about it.
Right.
But he was still taking boys to islands off Scotland.
He had a boat, didn't he?
But he got the boat given.
And then the boat got burnt, I think.
The boat blew up. Yeah, something like that, set on fire.
Very strange shenanigans.
Yeah, very strange scenario. And he was taking kids, 30, 40 kids to an island. And making them wear swimming trunks when it was freezing and taking pictures of them doing.
Yeah.
It's very, very.
But that story is virtually forgotten about now, isn't it? Dunblane story.
But she documented all the complaints about him in this book. Yeah. And, there's literally hundreds of complaints. And it's just like all these stories that are allowed to do these things. And then when it happens.
And the whole investigation got buried for 75 years. And
100? It's 100? 100,
100 years.
Might yeah, 100. I thought 25. It was 75. Yeah. 100 years. All the evidence is locked up for 100 years.
What tennis player was it that was...
Andy Murray.
It was Andy Murray, who was there at the time, Again, I mean, what are the chances?
It's weird, isn't it?
Mm. Billions of people on this planet, and it's always there's always a celebrity, attached to these sort of backgrounds and these situations, and what are the chances?
We're having a talk with a friend of ours, Jonathan Halstead, and when you do the bloodlines on these people, and you could say, Boris Johnson, I have to ask myself, well, Boris Johnson's siblings have the same bloodline, right? So why wasn't it one of them? Why is it him? Why is it not one of them? Yeah? All of them are successful, so the chances of all that family being successful. I think Stanley Johnson's got 7 kids or 6 kids or something. He's got 7 kids, actually. And he wants the population of Britain to be around about 15 million, apparently, he said. Well, he did say, I've got it on tape. So they're going to get rid of 60 million, but he's having seven kids, he's all right. But anyway, and that's another story. But all of them are successful in their own way, i.e. professional journalists, but high-up journalists, not, you know, one's a baron now, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the odds of that is you're going to get at least one dropout in a family of seven, aren't you? At least one. And anyway, but why Boris? Why Tony Blair? Why? I mean, Tony Blair's brother is Sir Something Blair. He's knighted as well. He's a high-up judge. He's one of the main judges. He looked after the private islands, like Cayman Islands and stuff. He was the Lord, whatever, advocate of one of these islands that basically had buried money everywhere. And I think he was in charge of the handover of Hong Kong. But so he's part of the establishment as his brother, but nobody's ever really is about his brother. But why not him? There must have been a reason why it's Tony Blair. So it has to be bloodline, but also something else, whether it's a spiritual...
His brother might have more clout than him, fair.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that we don't know who he is.
Yeah. The quiet ones are always maybe the quiet ones are the ones you should be looking out for and keeping an eye on.
Yeah, maybe he was better at presenting himself or talking or, you know.
Yeah. No idea. But I think there's more to it than just what my research has gone in my head is there's more to it than just the bloodlines. Bloodlines are a big part of it, there's no doubt about that. But there's something else. Maybe it's the hidden spiritual side of it so there's a biological DNA bloodline.
And also
a spiritual DNA.
Yeah, and also maybe they've got to train them from birth, from being a kid.
Yeah, the ideal candidate
role.
If you like.
Yeah, for that specific role.
Because not everybody's going to be psychotic, I suppose.
No, maybe checking for empathy.
Not everybody's going to have that sort of. They'll see the job done, regardless of how many people. I mean, Tony Blair. What, his decision killed a million people.
Yeah.
Probably that's on the low side.
Yeah. Just as a piss taker becomes a peace envoy for the Middle East.
Yeah, that worked.
Just as a right piss taker.
That worked. Apparently somebody was saying, sent me some stuff that there's oil under Palestine as well, found in 2019.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, that's another story. I'm not going to get into that one tonight. But some of the crossovers of your work were going back to the first Summer of Love, and you're saying the links to... London, but it started a long time before that, didn't it? When you actually dig into this, all right, the Beatles came around in the 60s. But imagine the amount of planning that went into saying, right, we're going to find the ideal vehicle to use. And they're not just going to say it's them four lads there. They'll have had loads of people on track, won't they, under the microscope. It is like that's what happens, isn't it? Like they've got these people, like Boris Johnson, Tony Blair, they're watching them all the way through. Keeping track of them.
There's some really weird. One of the reasons I like the Beatles, I'll admit I'm a Beatles fan. I like their music. I got into the Beatles when I was about 4 or 5 years old, when the so-called Red and the Blue album came out. Two compilations. One was the Red album was the Beatles 62 to 66, and then the Blue one was 67 to 70. And that is known as the gateway drug album because a lot of people who were born after the Beatles split up in the 70s, late 60s, like I was, they didn't live through the Beatles. So they got into liking the Beatles thanks to that album, our generation. So I've been into the Beatles since I was about three, four, 5 years old, listening to my sister's records, who's about 10 years older than me. So, you know, I've been a fan of them, but when I started to get into looking at the alternative world, you know, a few years back, I started to look at the Beatles through that lens as well.
Sorry, Matt. Just quickly. So is one of them the red or the blue one when they got into drugs kind of thing? Then is that what you're saying?
No, the red one it covers the early years. The blue one is the later years. So the red, they call it the Red and the Blue album, but they're not called that. That's their nickname.
Yeah,
The Beatles 1962 to 1966. That's the Red album.
Right.
Which is now called the Red Album because it's got a red border around it.
Yeah.
And then you've got the blue one, the Blue Album, which has got the blue border around it, and that's 1967 to 70. So one they're two sets of double albums. The first set, the earlier years, is like the mop top, cute, yeah, cuddly Beatles. And then the second one is all the psychedelic stuff and then all the rock stuff they did afterwards.
Really interesting. So, you got the red and the blue pill, or the red and the blue house, Masonic and, house or whatever. And the two different ones. Are you red or are you blue? Which one are you with?
That's brilliant. Yeah. That is brilliant. It's also the red and the blue of Freemasonry.
Yeah, that's what I meant. The red and the blue house, Freemason house. Yeah.
Yeah. And also they released a compilation years later in the 80s on CD when they repackaged all their stuff in the 80s on CD and they called them Past Masters.
Right.
Okay. So again, this Freemasonic, you know, sometimes you feel like they're rubbing it in your face.
Yeah. And I've seen them
out. Smacking your own face.
I think our parents had one of them done. Blue or red, I don't know which one. Quite a strange thing to do as well, isn't it? Because has it got the same picture on it, or is it a bit? It's the same version of that picture.
It's the same version of the picture. The red one, the earlier one, is them standing on, I think it's one of the EMI buildings. It's like an office block, and they're looking over the balcony. So that's 1963. And they used that cover for their first album, the Please Please Me album, which came out in 63. And then they thought, they went back to that same block of that building, I think it's an office block. It was the EMI building or one of the EMI buildings. And they went to that same balcony in 1969. They're not mop tops anymore. They've got long hair and beards and all of that. And they're leaning over, looking out in exactly the same position. So, so that's what you're getting, basically. It's the same picture, basically, but then recreating it sort of 7 or so years later. For me, that was like the gateway album.
I think that makes it more compelling, though, because if I hated the Beatles, right, when we did that thing on Jim Morrison, I'd no love or hate for the Doors, for argument's sake. So I went in it totally blind, because I didn't know the Doors. Yeah, so I didn't care whether they were fantastic or absolute, you know, whatever we found, whatever we were. But I think by liking the music and liking them, it's quite compelling when you have an about change. Not necessarily not liking the music anymore, but that you open that door to go through.
But it's not only the music it's the music. I mean, my sister had...
The music's the key. Yeah,
the music's the key, because she's 10 years older than me. So when I was 3, 4, she was 14. She was a teenage girl. So she was buying... I mean, I look back now and I think, wow, these records are brilliant. It was like T-Rex, Jeepster. She had the single of that. She had the Space Oddity album by David Bowie, which I smashed to 1,000 pieces because I was into dance music when I got older. And me and my mate thought it'd be funny to trample on the top of it. What a stupid thing to do. There was a couple of Slade singles as well, Far, Far Away, the Slade single, which I love that track. And there was this Beatles out, those Beatles albums. But I played all these singles, but the two that I just kept gravitating towards the most and got captivated by, and it was the music, it was the Beatles ones. And from that, as I got older and I got more and more addicted to them, I started following their story. And it's their story that's captivating as well, you know.
Story being the key word.
being the key word. The myth, if you like. And looking at it now from a conspiratorial angle, I mean, it's even more fascinating because people within the mainstream might say it's coincidental, like their path to fame is coincidental, and the story that came after their path to fame, their actual fame itself, was coincidental. But how many times can you call this coincidence before you start to think to yourself, wait a minute, something's not quite right here? I mean, if you look at the beat, I know we've discussed this before. I know you discussed this on Brave New World Order on your podcast.
No, let's do it, because we want to talk about overlaps. So we're going to repeat some stuff, so don't worry.
Okay. We mentioned it as well. You mentioned it. You guys mentioned it on the podcast, the second Summer of Love podcast we did with Mark Devlin. So, for example, talk about coincidences. We talked about the coincidences regarding the Asher family and Paul McCartney. Well, you can take... So basically, for those who aren't aware, basically Paul McCartney in 1963 started going out with the English actress Jane Asher, and they stayed together till about 1968, and then they split up, and he moved into the Asher's house. Dr. Richard Asher, who was an eminent doctor, specialized also was into administering sleep hypnosis, on his patients, which he wrote about in a documentation, a medical journal, which was titled, the piece was titled Respectable Hypnosis. And so he lived in this house in Wimpole Street in London where the Ashers lived. So there was Dr. Richard Asher. There was Margaret Asher, the mother, the wife of Dr. Richard. And there was Jane, this actress. And then there was Peter Asher, who was also in the 60s. He was in a duo, Peter and Gordon. And Paul wrote a song for him, which became a number one hit, World Without Love, I think in 1964. Anyway, turns out that sometime in the late 40s, I think, or in the early 50s, long before Paul McCartney even set foot in London, long before he was a Beatle, obviously, when he was a child, it turns out that Margaret, her mother, Jane Asher's mother, who was a teacher at the Guildhall School of Music, taught oboe to none other than the man who would become the Beatles' record producer, the so-called fifth Beatle, George Martin. I mean, what are the odds that she would be teaching all the places that he could have gone?
George Martin got into that university via the grant, whatever you want to call it, the army grant to go into extra learning or whatever you call it, to get sort of something behind you. So he left the army, didn't he? I believe.
He served during the war, yeah.
Yeah, and he got the, whatever you want to call it, paid for by the army to go into...
like a grant, like an army grant to go into.
What's it called? It's not a grant.
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean anyway, yeah.
When he was 11, he was also educated at a Jesuit school as well on a scholarship.
Why not?
So it said St. Ignatius, I think the name of the school is. Yeah. And the story is,
just to stop you there to recap, Matt, right? We could keep saying this. What are the odds or coincidence, right, of coincidence for him? Because he's no ordinary guy to be taught oboe by Margaret Asher, yeah, who then ends up being we'll call her mother-in-law, but mother-in-law to Paul McCartney for a number of years while he lived at their house.
Yeah.
And the dad's a hypnotist, which was probably quite controversial in that period.
Well, on PubMed, he came up with Munchausen syndrome, which is basically lying, right? Yeah. The art of lying, which is straight out of an MKUltra bloody book, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
But you imagine in them days, hypnosis would have been quite quite controversial, wouldn't it? I would imagine. Wouldn't have been like it is now, where it's...
Not unless you're Ewan Cameron.
Hypnotherapy, smoking.
Yeah, or William Sargent, who Dr. Richard Asher is rumoured to have conducted MKUltra-type experiments.
Or Johnny West or someone like that. It's not pretty normal for them to drug an elephant up and kill it. Yeah.
So the other thing is with George Martin, and again, this is very Laurel Canyon-esque. Okay, so we've got this guy who's classically trained, George Martin, who's a musician, who's a composer and becomes the head of EMI Studios during the 60s and in the 50s as well, I think. He was certainly very responsible for the running of it as a producer and arranger and all of that. He claims that... on the day that he got the job interview to go to Abbey Road to EMI Studios, he'd never heard of EMI Studios or EMI. I mean, the biggest record music company in the world, and he's never heard of it. Fine. So, yeah, you've got that connection going on. Here's another connection. And this is according to Mark Lewison, who is regarded within the mainstream as the foremost, topmost Beatles biographer. He is the number one man that you go to, okay? And because his research is very exhaustive. He goes through documents and double checks them and cross checks them, and he goes through every kind of record you can think of. He goes to local government buildings and gets all the documents out. He does all of that kind of stuff. Now, he claims, right, there's a guy by the name of Ivan Vaughan, right? And he used to go to school with Paul McCartney. Quarry Bank School that's where John Lennon went, the Liverpool Institute, which is quite elite school for brainy kids. So he used to go to school with Paul McCartney there, and Ivan also knew John Lennon. And the run of the mill mainstream story is that Ivan Vaughan is responsible for introducing Paul McCartney to John Lennon at the Walton Village Fete in Liverpool. I think 1956 or 57. I can't remember the year now. And it's from that meeting, thanks to Ivan, that the two, you know, John and Paul met. And then, of course, we get the story of the Beatles from that. John was playing in his band, The Quarrymen, at the time at a local village fete. What Mark Lewison has discovered, that what happened was Ivan Vaughan went to university and he went to London. So this would have been pre-fame Beatles days. We're talking 62, 63. And Paul McCartney went to visit him before he was famous. He went to visit Ivan in London. The apartment, it's either the apartment building or the actual apartment itself, but whatever, it's the apartment building or the actual apartment, but the same building, right, where Ivan Vaughan was in when he was a student, was in Portland Place in London, is the very same flat or flats or block of flats, small flats, where George Martin was taught the oboe by Margaret Asher just like 10 or 15 years before. Now, what are the chances of that? On top of that,
I would say quite wide.
Okay. There's more to it, because what Mark Lewison doesn't latch onto, which I realised from looking at his information, is, wait a minute, Ivan Vaughan at the time, to generate money so he could go to university, he got a job in London at the Establishment Club, which was like, it's regarded to be the first ever comedy club in London or even Britain. And it was run by Peter Cook, the comedian Peter Cook. And he was part of the Beyond the Fringe satire group, the satirical group of the early 60s. Other members of Beyond the Fringe included Dudley Moore, also, is it Alan Bennett?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, Alan Bennett.
Harry Seacombe, was it?
No, it was, it's gone now. Jonathan Miller. Jonathan Miller, who later became a director, Shakespearean, and a TV director and writer and all of that. Intellectual, so they say. Now, before Jonathan Miller was actually a registered doctor. He was trained as a doctor, but he tossed that all aside to become a comedian, to join this. This was in Cambridge University, right? So he dismisses his medical career to become a comedian with his satire group, Beyond the Fringe, which are regarded as the people who actually helped to invent alternative comedy, because they inspired Monty Python, for example, and they started that trail of alternative comedy back in the early 60s. Now, when Jonathan Miller was at medical school, when he graduated and he was training to be a doctor and he was in situ in a hospital, according to Jane Asher, the man who was training him, Jonathan Miller, was none other than Dr. Richard Asher. So again, we've got this connection going on. Just to point out that before Peter Cook joined Beyond the Fringe, he was actually going to join the Foreign Office. And I think he did go for an interview to the Foreign Office. Don't quote me on that part, but he did actually, he was actually thinking of joining the Foreign Office. So from the Foreign Office to making alternative comedy.
And, you know, what you're saying there, when we when I did the research on George Orwell, what me and Chris found, because sometimes when you do the research and you put it down, you'll know this man, you don't actually see a lot. You see some stuff and think, grab it. It's when you read it back through and you're both listening to it that you realise that the scope of what it is, it's a lot bigger than you expected. And some of the little things become massive things within the research. And the guys you're talking about there, some of them are probably meaningless to people who've listened to the Beatles, because you just think of the four guys who were in the Beatles and George Martin. That's all you think of, possibly the manager, right?
Yeah.
But all these other people, they're all like tentative links to, like, George Orwell. All the links went back to some sort of intelligence, Foreign Office, military, yada, yada, yada again. You know, Stephen Spender, who were part of that.
CCF.
CCF, that was basically run by the CIA. You've got them signed up with Parlophone and EMI, that's basically a military company that was set up during World War II. You know more about that.
Yeah, it was making radar, and in the 70s and 80s, it was like the UK's largest defence contractor.
And so let's just say you've got a group of guys who know actually what's going on. So it's a top table-ish type characters that say, right, in 20 years, we're going to come up with these people. We're going to have the technology to pump this frequency out. And they're going to do it while people are thinking they're actually going to enjoy it. Because while they're enjoying it, they're more susceptible to what we're pumping into their heads.
Yeah.
What's interesting there, though, Matt, is the Ashes then basically is bringing in the new version of comedy and music.
Yes.
He's responsible for both at the same time.
Well, there's more.
Because isn't the Miller guy, didn't he become an author? Was he an author?
Yeah, he was a director. He directed. When I think of Jonathan Miller, I think of Shakespeare, you know.
I think of Spit and Image. I think I remember him on Spit and Image. He had a massive nose, didn't he? And I think he had a big wrinkle in his face.
Do you know who his dad was? His dad was Emmanuel Miller, who was a psychiatrist, psychologist.
For Tavistock, we were talking about, and it's slightly, we're going to go on a sidewinder here, but we were talking about Draper being wheeled out at Baron Mandy's wedding. And Draper, I found out when we were doing going back 3 years ago, and we were doing research into him when we were being wheeled out, that he's a psychologist for Tavistock. He actually ran Tavistock. I'll give you the exact title that he had, just as a... But he was a director at Tavistock.
Of the clinic or the institute?
He's a trained psychologist, and he went to train in America by... the guy was called Sandman or Sanford. Not Stanford, Sanford.
Sanford, yeah, I saw the link you sent me.
Yeah.
Now, that's really interesting, because Draper, what was he... What I remember of Draper...
He was a PR guy, wasn't he? He was a spin doctor.
Right, in the New Labour.
Yes.
So-called New Labour. He was one of those... The group that you also had Mandy in there, Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, Alistair Campbell, the usual suspects, and him. I do remember him, because I used to keep quite an eye out for all these kind of things back in the 90s. I admit now that I used to watch things like Question Time, and I was well into all of that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Think you were clever.
And
Matt.
So,
you do
Question Time.
You think you're learning something?
Did you see yesterday's
edition? You know what I used to watch? I used to watch, what's that one, that satire one that Boris presented? Have I Got News For You?
Have I Got News For You? I used to love it.
It's terrible.
But now you watch it, and you can see that they're pushing agendas.
It's the same programming. It's the same programming that all the TV's giving you, just with a slight edge.
Yeah.
I mean, that fucking Ian Islop, right? That Ian Islop who writes Private Eye, right? Which is supposed to be satirical. Cutting edge, different version.
And that's Peter Cook, isn't it?
Yeah, it was Peter Cook. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But that's in every news agent in the country. He's got more court cases against him, apparently. How's he still functioning? It had crumbled years ago.
Yeah.
He's giving you an alternative version of the media, isn't it? But it's just the same stuff.
And again, it's a shame I haven't got all my notes here, because I do seem to recall, and it's in one of my articles on the occult Beatles, but I think that magazine, one of its shareholders was, or continues to be, Jane Asher and her husband Gerald Scarfe.
Jane Asher's husband Gerald Scarfe, is it? The artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I didn't know that.
Who did Bloody the Pink hell. Floyd, did all the wall art artistry. Yeah, I think it's him. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken. That's her husband.
All encompassing, you see. We've got everything. We've got the music, the comedy, you've got Private Eye, the alternative newspaper. Yeah. And you've even got the bloody artists.
But if you look at New Labour, the actual operation of New Labour was very similar to the Beatles launch, very similar to New Comedy. They've all got the same pattern to them, haven't they? They've all got the same people type of involved. Some of them are ideologists who don't even know they're being controlled, for argument's sake. Similar to Operation Mockingbird, for that type of operation where
New Labour,
99% of them. Don't know.
Oasis were down there shaking hands with Tony Blair and all sorts. Yeah. It was sickening, wasn't it? Spice Girls. They were dragging in every public personality to tell you that this new Labour, which were basically merging Tories and Labours, are all exactly the same.
That said, we think, or we wouldn't be surprised if Cool Britannia and Britpop was invented by the government. Was it Belle and Sebastian?
I don't know. Was it?
I remember
It's not a bad shout, though.
It could be Bell and Sebastian. Yeah. I think it was that band Bell and Sebastian who said it, but I might be wrong. But
if you think about what happened in the '90s, Matt, you've got the Cool Britannia nonsense, but before that, you've got the Britpop stuff, but also the football was in '96, the European Championships. That was massive because it never anything been like.
Was that the Vindaloo year when they were singing?
It was football's coming home apparently.
Same shit. Yeah. I don't know anything about football.
Skinner and Badil.
They did the Vindaloo thing because they did it with the artist. What's his name?
Keith Allen.
Keith Allen.
And Dennis. Right. Was it Dennis Pennis?
Dennis Pennis.
I think
he was. I used to love Dennis Pennis. He was
annoying, though, isn't
it? Yeah.
I look back at him, you want to nut him.
Yeah,
but it was funny at his time.
It was funny at the time, yeah. I'm trying to think. I'm sorry, I went quiet because I was trying to think of one or two of his one-liners. They were like classic.
I always remember seeing him interviewed. I saw him a couple of times in London because I used to work near... I saw him in the pub I worked in, actually, when I was a chef when I was younger. But he always regretted going up to Steve Martin because he was quite cutting, wasn't he? And he went up to Steve Martin and he said, "What's it like, Steve?" And he said, "What? Not being funny anymore." look on Steve Martin's face. He just goes grey. And he said he felt really bad for it if he said he went too far.
I found that quite funny, actually.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Well, it was true. It's true.
Steve
Martin was groundbreakingly funny.
He's only saying what thousands and millions of people are probably thinking. You know, he's just
But saying it to his face. Is it fair? I don't know. Well, it's been nasty.
Well, you don't live by the sword, you die by the sword. It's comedy. Live with it. You know.
Yeah.
As soon as he made Parenthood, it all went downhill. Oh, for Steve God. Martin.
Yeah. All these people, though, I'll use George Martin. They're all. I mean, he's obviously a talented guy, is George Martin. But it says here he's a producer, arranger, composer, or was, conductor, musician. He did get paid by his veterans grant, it said. I didn't even know British army serving guys got a veterans grant after World War II.
No.
That was news to me. But
he only served in the war. He didn't stay after the war, did he? He did his bit in the war.
He did his bit, yeah.
Yeah, and that was it, yeah.
I mean, but he worked with a lot of the guys, didn't he? He was going back to the comedy guys. He worked with, Peter Sellers and all that type, Spike Milligan and people like that, didn't he?
Yeah, and Beyond the Fringe
as
well. You know, the audience, I might be wrong again. I'm kind of going by memory. I might have got this wrong, but I think I'm right. With Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, at the beginning of that song, on the beginning of the album, you get an orchestra tuning up, and you've got audience in the background.
That's right, yeah.
Well, that was George Martin took that sample of audience from a Beyond the Fringe show that he'd gone and recorded. Right. So you've got that going full circle in a way. You've got the connections going all over the place, haven't you? But the Derek Draper. It's really interesting that he was a press guy for this New Labour con, and he worked for Tavistock so we're talking like Tavistock psychology being used by the New Labour government, you could argue, to push that New Labour quote unquote dream.
Now he's the most injured person in England who's had COVID.
Draper is a governor of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust.
Yeah.
I remember Mark when he saw that. You could see he wanted to, for fuck's sake, another one. You know, you just keep chalking these people up, don't you? He's got an ME in psychology from the Wright Institute in Berkeley that was set up by that guy we were just talking about, that Sanford geezer.
Sanford, yeah.
Yeah, Nevin Sanford or something like that, he was called. But he was a director at the Tavistock in the, like, obviously in the 50s and 60s, was this Sanford geezer.
I mean, the story is that we're told is that Hugh Crichton Miller, a psychologist, was the guy that brought the Tavistock Clinic into being in 1920. Supposedly because he'd served during the First World War and he'd seen, we now call it post-traumatic stress disorder, what they called it then, shell shock. And that was quite a new discovery back then for, you know, it was quite a new thing, you know, for doctors to identify and do something about it. So after the war, spurred on by that, having seen it, we're told, according to the official account, that's why the Tavistock Clinic was formed. It was basically a clinic where not only ex-servicemen could go, but also civilians. So it was like a civilian clinic to treat people with mental health problems, which all sounds very nice and cozy. But, you know, you just think to yourself, well, from the Tavistock Clinic, we get the Tavistock Institute for Human Affairs. So we've gone from helping people supposedly with mental health problems into having their tentacles in just about every aspect of... It's just what?
Just a natural step.
I know. I've got a quote here.
But then you look at Boris's mum. Boris's mum, she ended up... Stanley was quite abusive. Used to whack her, broke her nose. By her own, in a book, she acknowledged that he broke her nose. She ended up in the Maudsley Mental Institute in Britain when Boris was 10, getting cured.
Well, that's where William Sargent worked for a time. William Sargent, who's supposedly, it's rumoured, was MK Ultra, MI5, MI6, the whole lot. You know, look at the list. He was there. You know, it's never been proven. But he is, one of his nicknames is the Mindbender General, because
he might be Genderbender General now.
yeah. Well, if he's going to work for Tavistock.
Why not?
I've got a quote here. And this is actually from, sometimes you get the best research from the actual horse's mouth. Yes. I've got a quote here from one of the Tavistock Institute's websites. And this was put up about 100 to mark the centenary of the Tavistock Clinic, so 2020. And this is what it says. It says, in our earliest history, and this illustrates how it went from helping the mentally vulnerable to having its tentacles in everything. In our earliest history, just over a centenary ago, a group of medical professionals who called themselves the Tavistock Group worked with the British Army to help soldiers who had been prisoners during World War One return to civilian life, and equally as importantly, to help their families and communities adjust to having them back. From returning soldiers to rapid changes in business management, workplace demographics, and the adoption or rejection of new technologies throughout the 20th century, to the global social changes of the 21st century, we pour ourselves into organizations needing change, individuals needing change, systems needing change. What arises from the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations isn't abstract. It's applicable study making a difference in all of our lives. So that just about says it all.
It encompasses everything.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely sums up what they've been doing with the LGBT whatever shenanigans.
Well, I was saying to someone today that they were asking me, you know, what's going to happen? I said, well, it's happening. I mean, they know the Nudge Unit, Spy B, Tavistock, CIA, MI6. They know that humans can only handle two traumas at once, and then they're stuck. Yeah, they don't know whether to stick or twist. But what we're getting fired with at the minute is different traumas. The property market's going to collapse, interest rates going up, oil's going up, there's a war, there's a virus, there's a this, there's a that, you need a jab. Every trauma you can think of, and all of a sudden nobody knows how to think or make a straight decision. And music plays a massive part in that. We were talking about comedy before, because obviously Matthew Perry, he's just passed away this week. Another one to add to chalk up to that list. I think one of his last tweets or recent tweets, I think it was sometime in October, said you can't be too boosted.
Oh yeah, you can't be more vaccinated or something. Yeah,
no, he said you can't be too boosted.
Okay.
You can't be too boosted. So even now they're knocking off people with. If you think about it, who's actually in the in crowd? You know, going back to the Tavistock, the top table, who's actually in? I mean, you look at people like you and Cameron or Jolly West and people like these. These people weren't in the in crowd, but they were the dogs doing the biting for them. And they didn't care who they ruined or killed on their own side, let alone any enemies. Everyone was a combatant in their eyes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you've got these people behind, like Asher, who I would say, if you were going to hazard a guess, you'd say, with links he had and the work he was doing, he had to be some kind of intelligence behind there, that connection.
Paul McCartney reckons that the song Yesterday came to him in a dream. So this is 19...
An Italian dream. It was
living with a hypnotist and a song comes to you in a dream.
Exactly. He woke up, he says he woke up with the song in his head. And he also said the same about Eleanor Rigby as well. Eleanor Rigby came to him in a dream. And the whole Asher thing, Dr. Richard Asher, how that his death just is well weird. It's just well weird. He, according to what reports you read, and I've noticed now on Wikipedia, apparently the official cause of death is suicide. But if you look on Wikipedia now, they've actually changed it from being suicide to allegedly suicide. They might have changed it again since then. It was a while back since I looked, but I thought that was quite interesting. But apparently, according to the official account,
I think he died suddenly now, Matt.
Exactly. He was found in the basement of the house with a load of bottles around him. I think it was an overdose. I can't quite remember. Depending on what version you read, it's slightly different. But he'd been reported missing for 7 days. According to one report, he'd been reported missing for 7 days in March 1968. So he's reported missing by his family for 7 days. No one bothered to look downstairs in the basement in 7 days.
Maybe it was like a Batman one through a bookcase. Where you put your hand in a goldfish bowl. Like
Scooby-Doo. Yeah.
I mean, come on, man. It's mental, isn't it?
Mental.
I mean,
throwing your own guys under the bus. Did he do all that work with the comedy and the music and then they ousted him?
I think he retired as well, didn't he? In 1963 or 64, he was working in a hospital in London, I think, as a general practitioner, and he just retired from the job and to spend more time at home. So he was taking in home patients, I think, and that was the time that McCartney moved in, 63. That's when he moved into the Asher house. That's when Asher kind of stopped working in the hospital. Semi-retirement. Yeah. Another coincidence, you know. And then, you know, McCartney's waking up with songs in his head, you know.
Neapolitan songs in his head.
Neapolitan.
That were played 150 years before. There's an interview of him saying, I think it was Mike Williams that dug it out, that said he were asking people, going, John, did you write this song? Oh, it must have been me then. Must be mine.
That quote, doesn't that remind you of that film they made? I never watched it yet. I will watch it, actually. The one where the kid writes a song, and he's writing McCartney songs, Beatles songs that never...
Yesterday.
Right. Yeah, I've not watched it. Have you watched it, Matt?
Has it got any clues in that? Oh, yeah, I had to watch it because I've got a podcast series called Magical Mystery Talk, and that was on the very first episode that me, Mark Devlin, and fellow Beatles blogger Desiree. That was the first episode. The first episode we recorded, that was when that film came out, so we had to go and watch it. Otherwise, I don't think I would have gone, to be honest. It's horrible. It's a terrible film. But yeah, apparently it's the story of some bloke who is a talentless musician, and he writes these songs and sings them in empty pubs, I think. I can't quite remember now. It was a while back.
I think he gets struck by lightning. And then when he comes
around, everybody
Beatles songs didn't exist. Basically.
He
starts writing them.
He has a moped crash or a motorbike crash.
Where I got the lightning from.
It might be lightning. I can't remember. And then he wakes up in this other world where no one's ever heard of the Beatles. So he passes himself off. He thinks, wait a minute, I can, you know, he plays Yesterday or a song on his guitar to his friends on his acoustic. I think it's Yesterday or one other Beatles song. And they look at him and say, oh, that's beautiful. He goes, well, yeah, of course it is. John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote that. And they say, who? He goes, are you pulling my leg or something? What do you mean, who? He goes, what? The Beatles, you know. What do you mean, who? He goes, what are the Beatles? What's that? That sounds stupid. What silly name. And it turns out that he's in this other world where they've never heard of the Beatles, so he passes off their songs as his own, and he becomes this huge star. So you could say there's like an occultic clue being given to us.
Written by Richard Curtis. I'm just having a quick look now. And he's married to a lady called Emma Freud.
And she is directly related to the Freuds, isn't she?
Yeah. And so it was Danny Boyle, wasn't it, who did the directing of it.
So Freud takes us to Edward Bernays as well. Yeah.
Well, we're back. I mean, if you look at Slumdog Millionaire and then look at Rishi Sunak,
Mm.
Right? I've got pictures that they just looked exactly the same. I mean,